Hello everyone, and welcome to a new year and a new episode. I earnestly do hope that this year will turn out to be better than the last two. Well, the last time we were here, Jalaluddin, a leader of the Khilji Afghans, had just overthrown the last of the Balbanid rulers and had declared himself Sultan, only to be lured into a trap and murdered in full public view by his nephew Ali. Ali then went on to declare himself Sultan in Kara, in modern-day Uttar Pradesh, and took the title of Alauddunya wa Deen, or as we know him, Alauddin Khilji. For simplicity's sake, I will continue to refer to him as Ali. So whenever you hear Ali, you can snap right to Alauddin. The reign of Alauddin has in recent years become something of a muddled mess in public knowledge. This is a confusion that I think is reflected even in writings of this period historically. From as early as the Mughal period, the reign of Alauddin has been something of a hot subject to write about, because he is seen as the architect of the pre-Mughal state in India. There are generally two broad categories of historians who write about, or rather who are quoted for the reign of Alauddin. The first are the older generation, by which I mean 16th and 17th century historians, chief among them Abul Fazl, Akbar's biographer, who spent a considerable portion of the Akbarname talking about pre-Mughal India, who regard Alauddin as this visionary ruler, preemptor of Akbar and all that. And then there is the nationalist school of historians who wrote mainly in the late 19th and early 20th century, who, while not really refuting that idea, nonetheless tend to put a lot of emphasis on this perceived lusting for Hindu women in Alauddin. And this is a reputation that is in no small part contributed to by the entire myth of Rani Padmini. And I say myth because the first recorded story about Rani Padmini and Alauddin was written by a Sufi poet called Malik Muhammad Jayasi. He was writing well over 200 years later. And his particular work, the Padmavat, from which it is the story comes, is not a part of Tariq literature or Tawarikh literature. This basically is a body of literature that is regarded as a chronicle or an account of history. His is considered a work of fiction. But historians have, for whatever reason, taken this to be a literal narrative of what actually happened. The primary sources that are used for this period rely mainly on the works of Ziauddin Barani and Amir Khusro. Both of these can be considered highly reliable sources because Ziauddin Barani grew up during the reign of Alauddin, and his uncle, whom we shall meet very soon, served as an important noble in Alauddin's court, while Amir Khusro, the famous Sufi saint, or rather the famous Sufi poet, was also an official at court, and he was in charge of drafting many of the orders issued by Ali. So he too had close access to the Sultan, and he wrote an account of the Sultan's reign which again has the value of being an eyewitness account. While going through these two, it's really hard not to miss the fact that the version of the story that the primary sources tell doesn't quite match up to that of later historiography. While Alauddin certainly did bring about a lot of social and economic changes, he did undertake many projects for the welfare of the people, it would be stretching it a bit to say that Alauddin was concerned for the welfare of the people. The primary sources make it very clear that the only welfare Alauddin cared about was his own. And all these measures were meant as a way of bolstering his authority and wasn't done out of any high-minded idealism. But at the same time, it's also difficult to swallow the more recent narrative of this hyper-sexual, hyper-cruel ruler who's come to be portrayed in popular media. And one does find it odd that even very eminent historians such as R.C. Majumdar and J.P. Mehta nonetheless subscribed to that view. There's one particular passage in J.P. Mehta's book where when he writes about the story of Rani Padmini, he admits that none of the primary sources from the period talk about this incident and that the first mention of this is two centuries later, but then quite inexplicably adds that since so many people believe it, it must be true. Which, well, I mean, it's very iffy. Modern day historiography on this period, of course, has long since moved away from the heading of character of the ruler. And so nobody has really bothered to try and dissect Alauddin's reign in such detail. But this is a podcast, and this being a narrative of his reign, it's not really possible to steer clear entirely of his character. So I will try and stick as much as I can to the commonly accepted narratives, historically sound ones, and where there is too much divergence, I propose to stick to the version in Barani's work. So I've given you a warning beforehand. Dear listeners, also be forewarned that I do not like this man one bit. Impartiality and all that be hanged. He comes off in any source as a greedy, avaricious, unprincipled, an entirely unscrupulous ruler who, I mean, even though he did bring about a few reforms, as I said earlier, couldn't care less about the welfare of anybody except himself. So, a little bit of this story, I suppose, is going to be colored by my own opinion of him. But hey, this is my podcast, so I think that liberty I do possess. Well then, getting back to the story. So the year is 1296. Jalaluddin has just been publicly beheaded and his now considerably lighter head has been paraded right through the different cities of the Sultanate, and Alauddin is the new Sultan. Now his position in Kara is far from secure. True, he does have the gold of Devagiri behind him, but as I'm sure most of you would have gathered by now, wealth was not the sole legitimizer of anybody's reign, I'd say pretty much in any part of history. And Alauddin had the same problem. He had just committed regicide. He had killed his own uncle, and that too through trickery. and his uncle had children who could inherit the throne. So his usurpation of the throne was certainly not going to go unchallenged. Therefore, Alauddin deemed it wise to remain in Kara, buy as much support for himself as possible, and wait for his cousins to make the first move. The obvious candidate for the throne was Jalaluddin's eldest son, Arkali Khan, who at that time was away in Multan, manning the frontiers against the Mongols. He had proven himself to be a competent military leader in the past, and naturally, most of the Jalali nobles, that is to say, the nobles who had allied themselves to Jalaluddin, in contrast to the Alai nobles, who were those who supported Ali in this war, most of the Jalali nobles were rallying around Arkali Khan. But the Jalali faction effectively shot itself in the foot when Jalaluddin's wife and Arkali Khan's mother, for reasons best known to herself, instead proclaimed her younger son, Ruknuddin Ibrahim, as Sultan in Delhi, and then started issuing orders as his regent. Needless to say, this pissed off a good many people, not the least of them being Arkali Khan himself, who either left Delhi to try and join Arkali in Multan or just decided that the cause of the Jalali faction was a lost one and simply defected to Alauddin's side. As these desertions became more and more frequent, the Sultana realized rather late that it was a mistake to leave Arkali out. And I really don't get what this woman was thinking when she did it. She then wrote to Arkali Khan saying, "Well, if you will please come back from Multan with your army to Delhi, we'll negotiate a settlement." Naturally, Arkali Khan refused. And I'm sure that Ali was just as surprised as we are. He expected that he would soon be facing an army led by Arkali, bearing down on him to avenge his father's death. Instead, he was now witnessing the Jalali faction tear itself apart before his eyes as an increasing number of nobles decided to pitch their lot in with him. So, he began a slow march northwards, during which Barani says that he ordered his followers to liberally distribute the money and hire recruits for an army without taking any kind of surety and without paying too much attention to how much was being charged and so on, so that he would have a large enough army when he came to Delhi. It took him an entire 5 months to march from Kara to Delhi. Of course, this was the monsoons, but still, 5 months is quite a long time even by medieval standards. But when he got to Delhi, he found that most of the soldiery and nobles had already defected to him. Ruknuddin Ibrahim did try to muster an army and face him in battle, but once the army rode out of the fort, most of them just defected on the spot and Ruknuddin Ibrahim had to turn around and flee. So he, his mother, some of the more hardcore loyalists, then fled Delhi to Multan, where Arkali was currently sulking. 5 months after his uncle's assassination, Ali was able to enter Delhi. And for the next few months, it was party time. In the meantime, Arkali was in Multan and gathering forces, but Arkali had lost his best chance. By allowing Alauddin to take Delhi, he had signaled this great reluctance to take up the mantle of Sultan in the eyes of the people. And as easy as it is for us to say, well, you know, it's not too late, he could still try and gather support. Optics is everything, and here clearly Ali had optics in his favor. So soon after coming to Delhi, Ali dispatched two of his famous generals, Ulugh Khan and Zafar Khan, to bring Multan to heel. Now, Ulugh and Zafar were among some of the many nobles Ali had promoted when he became Sultan. Four names are extremely important for us in this narrative, and so I do urge you to remember them. The first, of course, is Ulugh Khan, which is a title Ali gave to his younger brother. The second is Zafar Khan, who also was a distant relative of Ali. And Alp Khan was one of his cousins. The fourth and final one, Nusrat Khan, was a very staunch Alai noble who was of not particularly distinguished birth, but who seemed to have caught Ali's fancy quite early on and remained by his side right throughout his reign. These four men, and both Barani and Khusro speak of this, were supremely talented military commanders. Again, at the risk of being biased, in my very, very humble opinion, if Alauddin was remembered as a great conqueror, it was because of these men and not any great military talent of his own. Again, that's just my opinion. Anyway, Ulugh Khan and Zafar Khan made quick work of the challengers to the throne in Multan. After a two-month siege, the Kotwal of the fort surrendered and all his men defected to Alauddin, handing over Jalali nobles and Jalaluddin's sons to Ulugh and Zafar. Under the promise of safe passage, they were brought back to Delhi, where Nusrat Khan, who had now been appointed the vizier or prime minister, then had them stripped of all valuables, had both the sons blinded, all the women and the few remaining Jalali nobles confined to their homes, and then proceeded to have all of Arkali Khan's sons put to the sword. Although at this time it seemed something very prudent for Ali to do, given that he had just murdered their grandfather, this extinction of the entire Jalali line would come back to bite the Khiljis after Alauddin's death. And I don't want to be giving out any spoilers here. Whatever the case, the first year was overall quite a successful one for Ali. He had successfully weathered the challenge to his authority, and he was now firmly entrenched as Sultan in Delhi. The money from his Devagiri expedition was still in abundance, and for now he could afford to relax and party. The very next year, though, he would come in for something of a jolt when the Mongols began raiding again. Once again, he sent his generals, and the Mongols were thoroughly routed and sent fleeing back across the border. But this should have brought home to Ali that any sense of security was only temporary. That year, he also sent expeditions to Gujarat and Sindh. Now, if you will recall, Gujarat had come under attack right from the time of Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni, who had raided Somnath. Muizuddin of Ghor had also attacked Gujarat but had been defeated. And subsequently, his slave Qutbuddin Aibak, the first Sultan, had campaigned in Gujarat and won a few battles. But Gujarat had not been annexed to the Sultanate. This first expedition that Ali sent to Gujarat was also just a raiding party. There doesn't seem to have been any effort made to hold on to the land. Led by Nusrat Khan, the expedition defeated Karan Rai, the ruler of Gujarat, who was then forced to flee into the interiors and hide out in the hills, while Nusrat Khan then ravaged the countryside and looted to his heart's content. One particular event of importance here was Nusrat Khan's raid of Kambayat, or the port of Cambay, which for almost a millennium before Alauddin's time had served as perhaps the most important port on India's western coast. So obviously it was quite wealthy, and Zia tells us that Nusrat Khan extorted huge amounts from the merchants of Kambayat. One catch in particular is going to be a very, very, very important figure for the future narrative. Also an extremely controversial figure, and that was a slave whom Nusrat Khan, in air quotes, convinced his master to hand over. A certain slave known as Malik Kafur, a eunuch, who it was said was so highly valued that he was purchased for 1,000 dinars, hence the name Hazar Dinari. So with all this loot, Nusrat Khan marched back. On the way back, an incident occurred which should tell you something about Nusrat Khan and in extension about Alauddin as well. Zia Barani tells us that as the army marched back through Rajasthan, Nusrat Khan began to make allegations of soldiers misappropriating the share of the loot meant to go to the central government, and therefore started confiscating loot from different soldiers. This, of course, did not sit very well with many of his men, particularly the newly converted Mongols who had defected to the Sultanate and joined the Imperial Army. There was a revolt, and although the revolt was eventually quelled, Nusrat Khan had to drop these investigations into misappropriated loot. And when he got to Delhi, this is the important bit, Alauddin had the family members of the revolting soldiery sold into slavery for their disobedience, and then had all the rebellious soldiers dismissed. Here, at least for me, is a typical is a very typical Alauddin thing to do. The soldiers were rebellious because his general Nusrat Khan was trying to squeeze them for gold, and Alauddin decides to punish the soldiery instead of his vizier. Well, such is the way of the world. This was also around the same time that Nusrat Khan initiated a widespread purge of Jalali nobles from the court. Now, these were the nobles who had not switched over to Alauddin's side. Their property was confiscated, they were dismissed from the positions they held, they were jailed under different pretexts, and fines were again extorted, all of which went into the central treasury and then out in all the parties that were being thrown in the city. The same year, Zafar Khan also led an expedition to Sindh. It so happened that one of Ali's brothers, deciding that if Ali could usurp the throne for himself, he could do the same, had taken refuge in the fortress of Sivistan, modern-day Sehwan, in Sindh province of Pakistan. And he'd been joined there by a group of Negudari Mongols. I won't go into the details of who the Negudaris were, but suffice it to say that the Negudaris were Mongol troops who didn't really belong to any one person. Caught up in the Mongol civil war, they wandered around until they eventually landed up on India's borders, where they would simply fight for whoever offered them the highest sum. In this case, the new claimant to the throne was offering them a good sum, so they joined him there instead. Again, Zafar Khan won a spectacular victory, which Zia says was won after a considerable battle. And since the Neguderis had brought with them a lot of the looted goods from neighboring areas, when the city fell, Zafar Khan was again in possession of huge sums of money, all of which came back to the capital. By now, it's the year 1299. And if we are to look at it from Ali's angle, it's been nothing but success throughout. All his rival claimants to the throne had been put down. There had been two successful expeditions against external enemies, one of which could be spun as a jihad against the Hindus. There was so much wealth around that Alauddin's expenditure could afford to be loosened quite without restraint. And at least for the moment, any voices of dissent had been silenced with either the threat of violence or the promise of gold. And this is when Ali sort of starts getting unhinged, if I might say so. Zia Barani tells us that it was around this time that Ali got it into his head that since he had four great generals and the Prophet Muhammad had also had four companions with whom he had established Islam as a religion, he, Ali, could now establish a new religion of his own. This, of course, was blasphemy, and no one in their right minds supported an idea like this. But given the atmosphere of terror that existed around the Sultan, nobody had the guts to tell him that. Extending the same analogy, he also argued that just as Alexander the Great had had great generals who had helped him conquer the world, he too would set out on this expedition to conquer the entire world after he had equipped his army with enough men and material, for which he would pay through the loot he had obtained from Devagiri. He even started calling himself Sikandar Sani or Alexander II, and had this name inscribed on all his coins. That in itself was not particularly surprising. A lot of rulers in the past had done that, and claiming grandiose titles isn't a particularly unheard of thing in the corridors of power. But what his generals and many of his nobles did find disturbing was the fact that Alauddin seemed to hint at making preparations for such an expedition eastward against the Mongols. There was some reason behind his suggestion, of course, which was that by now the Mongols had descended into a brutal civil war and were a shattered force. But that did not mean that the Mongols were not a formidable force. So there was a lot of unease about this increasingly hostile posturing towards the Mongols. Nobody wanted to provoke an attack. So as the third year of his reign progressed, there were beginning to be whispers around court of a plot to overthrow the Sultan. Naturally, since it was being plotted by the very supporters on whom Ali depended, it didn't get to him. But it did reach the ears of a particularly important noble, a certain Malik Ain-ul-Mulk, who it so happens was the uncle of our man Zia Barani. Ain-ul-Mulk had served as the Kotwal in Kara during Alauddin's governorship there, and after his ascension to the throne, Ali had him made Kotwal of Delhi, which at that time was a pretty powerful position since the Kotwal was in charge of the capital when the Sultan was away on campaign. Ain-ul-Mulk managed to talk him out of it with liberal amounts of buttering up and historical anecdotes and, oh, you know, how the times have changed and all that. And the entire court heaved a collective sigh of relief. If Ali needed any convincing that his ideas were terrible, he didn't have to wait much longer. That winter, the Sultanate would face one of the largest Mongol expeditions in recent years. As a bit of a background to this, I'd quickly need to hop back over to Central Asia, where if you could recollect the map that I had put up of the Mongol Empire, which had fragmented into four bits, the middle bit which controlled Central Asia, that was hemmed in on all sides by other khanates except to the southeast where it bordered the Sultanate, was the Chagatai Khanate. And I had mentioned in the past as well that the Chagatai Khanate was both the poorest of the four khanates and the one that had the least opportunity for enrichment, since the only non-Mongol lands available for it to raid were India. In the intervening years since the death of Balban, the Chagatai Khanate had further split, and one part of the Khanate was at war with the remaining three Mongol Khanates that surrounded it, while the other was placed under a puppet ruler known as Duwa Khan. Now Duwa, in the chaos of the ensuing civil war, desperately wanted to claim legitimacy as the sole ruler of the Khanate, and so proposed, as a way of a peace offering to all the remaining Khans, that the Mongols should once again unite and send an army to India. Although everybody in principle agreed to this, and some of contingents did indeed arrive from the Jochid and Ilkhanate realms, a majority of the force was still Chagatai. And Barani tells us that there were as many as 200,000 men. Again, might be a bit of an exaggeration, but we just take that figure for now, and sent them on a conquest of India led by his son, Kutluk Khwaja. This army, unlike the previous Mongol incursions, where the Mongols had pillaged, burnt, and looted their way across the whole of Punjab, this army just made a straight beeline for Delhi. The implications were clear. They were here to take Delhi. They were not here for plunder alone. And as they advanced, panic spread in the countryside. People fled into the city of Delhi, and within weeks, there was a state of famine within the city. There was a shortage of food and grains. This is when, and I give him credit for this, Ali again acted swiftly and decisively. He ordered his entire army to move out of the city and encamp on a plain just outside the city known as Siri. Again, a name you might want to remember because it's going to become important in future episodes. And there he held consultation with his nobles. Although the overwhelming majority of them suggested that the army and the Sultan withdraw further into India and abandon Delhi to the Mongols at least temporarily, Ali put his foot down and refused, and instead said that they would stand and fight. And so, at the end of 1299, the beginning of 1300 CE. His army marched around 16 miles out of Delhi to another fairly flat area known as Keeli. Arriving there, they set up camp, and the next morning, the Mongols also reached the place. Both armies drew up, ready for battle. In terms of numbers, Zia does not give us an exact figure for Alauddin's forces, but we can surmise from his description that the forces were probably equally matched in terms of numbers, with the Sultanate forces slightly outnumbering the Mongols. But what is undisputable is that in terms of composition, tactics and training, both armies were almost identical. The Sultanate armies had been swollen by refugees fleeing the Mongol civil war, and they had adopted both the Mongols themselves into the army, as well as Mongol horse archer tactics, which meant that now the Mongols no longer enjoyed the tactical superiority that they once did. In addition to that, the Sultanate armies were veteran armies. They had fought Mongols on several previous occasions. They had been serving under Uluk Khan and Zafar Khan in previous campaigns, and they were fiercely loyal to their commanders and to their cause. Whereas the Mongols, although a vast majority of them were from the Chagatai Khanate, many of them were also mercenaries who had been hired specifically for this campaign, and at least some of them seemed to be under the impression that this was a campaign for loot. So morale was already low because of the dash through Punjab where no looting had been permitted. So the disposition of the armies was in the typical Turco-Mongolic fashion, with a center and two wings, almost all of it composed of cavalry. In the Sultanate side, the center was commanded by Ali himself, while his left wing was commanded by Nusrat Khan and his right wing by Zafar Khan. On the Mongol side, Kutluk Khwaja, the Mongol commander and crown prince, commanded the center, while his subordinates commanded the two wings. Late in the morning, the battle began when Zafar Khan ordered the Sultanate right wing to charge the Mongol left. Almost on contact, the Mongol left wing broke and was pushed back. As panic spread and the Mongols began to flee, Zafar's men chased them down, and what followed was a massacre. But in doing so, Zafar had overextended his own line, and he was now at the risk of being cut off from the main body of the Sultanate armies. The Mongols, however, did not immediately make to pursue him out of the fear that Ali and Nusrat Khan would then use that opportunity to order their own contingents to charge, and thus the Mongols would be trapped between Zafar Khan and the main Sultanate forces. Much to everybody's surprise, neither Nusrat Khan nor Ali made any move to go to the aid of Zafar Khan. It turns out that Ali had become very suspicious of Zafar Khan's popularity after the Sindh expedition, when people quite rightly began to say that it was Zafar Khan's military genius which had brought victory to them. And Nusrat Khan was also jealous of Zafar Khan's fame and popularity, and so the two of them had decided that with the Mongol invasion as a cover, it would be a good time to get rid of Zafar Khan, and now they were just going to let him die. The units under Zafar Khan put up a stubborn resistance and were almost all killed to the last man. Zafar Khan himself was taken prisoner, and Kutluk Khwaja, supposedly impressed by Zafar Khan's bravery, offered him the title of Sultan as a subordinate to his father Duba Khan in Central Asia if Zafar Khan agreed to defect and join the Mongols. Although he had been abandoned by his own ruler, it goes to Zafar Khan's credit that right till the end he remained loyal to his Sultan and in the face of certain death refused to defect, at which point Kutluk Khwaja had him executed. By now night had fallen and both armies retired to their camp, and the next morning the Sultanate armies once again arrayed themselves in battle formation. Much to their surprise, they found that the Mongols had disappeared. It seems that either during the struggle to capture Zafar Khan or during his execution, Kutluk Khwaja had been badly wounded, and the Mongols had been so badly demoralized by Zafar Khan's initial victory that in the night, individual contingents and small groups had started fleeing, and soon the entire army had followed suit, retreating towards the Indus. By the time the new year dawned, the Mongol armies were back across the frontiers. Kutluk Khwaja had died only a few days later of his wounds. And although the Mongols did not know it at that time, this was the closest they would ever get to winning a decisive battle in India. From now on, it was going to be all downhill for them. So Ali returned to Delhi, hailed as a hero, somewhat shaken, for Ain al-Mulk's prediction that should he leave Delhi unattended to, it would almost certainly come in for attack from outside. And before the new year was over, he would also receive confirmation of Ain al-Mulk's other prediction that most of his subordinates could not be trusted with command. His own nephew, son of one of his younger brothers, decided that when Alauddin was busy with the Mongols, he would make trouble in Kara and try to seize the throne for himself. Of course, at this time, Alauddin had just departed Delhi for an attack on Ranthambore, one of the many recalcitrant Hindu fortresses which had initially submitted to the Sultans of Delhi, but during the periods of civil war and strife had managed to throw off their yoke. And when news reached him of this rebellion, he sent his older brother Uluk Khan to suppress the revolt. The revolt was duly suppressed, but Ali had learnt his lesson. There was no longer going to be any talk of world conquest, of starting a new religion, and he would instead focus on consolidating his own power. But it's also from this point that we begin to get hints of the sort of paranoia that would grip Ali later in his reign, where he was suspicious of anybody and everybody and exercised the sword quite liberally to ensure that there was no opposition to him. Upon his return to Delhi, Alauddin felt confident enough of his own position to order the execution of all the Jalali nobles who had defected to his side during his rebellion, stating that if they were so disloyal to his uncle, what guarantee did he have that they wouldn't betray him to some other usurper? As Barani very succinctly puts it, the master traitor betrayed the other traitors at court. So I'll leave the story here for now. Alauddin is now the unquestioned Sultan of Delhi. The Mongols have been dealt a serious defeat. Although not quite there, Alauddin will soon launch expeditions to bring back into the Sultanate the lands that had broken away. And within a few years, with North India secure, the Northwest frontier quiet, he would finally turn his eyes back south and look to annex Devagiri entirely. All that in the next episode. Thank you so much for your time and patient hearing. If you like what you hear, please do leave a rating on your podcast catcher. Both Spotify and Apple Podcasts allow that now. You can also check out the website, although I'm terribly sorry it hasn't been updated. There are quite a few episodes pending. I've simply not had the time to do it. You can leave comments there. You can also follow me on Instagram at the handle Dr. Abul Fazal in a Chair, which you'll find in the description. You can leave me a message there as well. You can also reach me by email for those of you who still use that kind of thing. Your feedback is always welcome. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you in the next episode.